From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Bill Duke about why he doesn't want to be typecast as a black film director. He directed the films A Rage in Harlem and Deep Cover, as well as hundreds of television shows. His latest film, The Cemetery Club, is about three older Jewish widows. Also, we talk with journalist Betty Rollin about how much more we know about breast cancer than 17 years ago, when Rollin first got the disease. Her best-selling book, First You Cry, is being reissued. And commentator Maureen Carrigan reviews a new memoir by H.L. Mencken, just published 37 years after his death. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton made his first out-of-town trip today. He's in Detroit for a broadcast town meeting on his economic plan. NPR's White House correspondent Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton is revisiting one of his favorite campaign formats this evening. He'll be answering questions from a television talk show audience in the Rust Belt city of Southfield, Michigan. Instead of riding a bus, the populist symbol of his presidential campaign, Mr. Clinton arrived in Detroit this afternoon on Air Force One. About 60 people have been chosen by television station WXYZ to ask the president questions about his economic plan, which is expected to include tax hikes and benefit cuts for most Americans. They'll be joined by audiences in Seattle, Atlanta, and Miami via satellite. As soon as Mr. Clinton finishes his sales pitch, Vice President Al Gore will begin his own televised town meeting in Ontario, California. The White House plans many more of these electronic sales sessions as the president searches for ways to bypass the press corps and take his case directly to the American people. In Detroit, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Clinton signed a series of orders today that will eliminate about 100,000 government jobs, cut government administrative costs, and abolish about a third of advisory boards and commissions. The job cuts are expected to be accomplished through attrition by the end of 1995. About 200,000 workers quit or retire from the government's 2.1 million member civilian workforce each year. The president said he wants administrative costs, including such things as travel and supplies, to be cut by 14% by 1997. The austerity orders would also eliminate some of the perks enjoyed by senior officials, including some limousine service and exclusive use of executive dining rooms. Pope John Paul ended his 8-day pilgrimage to Africa today, holding a mass public prayer service in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports.
An estimated crowd of more than 200,000 people attended an open-air mass conducted by Pope John Paul II in Khartoum. The pontiff used the occasion to call for tolerance and an end to religious persecution and human rights abuses in the Muslim-led country. A civil war between the fundamentalist Muslim military regime and rebels from the mostly Christian South is entering its 11th year. About 4 million people in the southern Sudan are now threatened by continued warfare and famine as the government prepares for a major offensive. The Pope also met today with Sudan's military leader, General Omar Hassan al-Bashir, giving him a stern lecture on the need for religious, political, and ethnic reconciliation. Meanwhile, the New York-based Africa Watch Human Rights Group issued a report charging the Sudanese government with the systematic discrimination and human rights abuses against its Coptic Christian minority. I'm Sunni Khalid in Washington.
The Dow Industrials lost about 2 points today to close at 3,412. This is NPR News. Military commanders in Somalia say that one of the country's more belligerent faction leaders has agreed to abide by a ceasefire. Major General Stephen Arnold said today that Mohamed Siad Hirsi, known as General Morgan, has begun to cooperate with U.S. soldiers and diplomats. Morgan was accused of attacking a rival faction leader in the southern part of the country last month, and a column of his soldiers was attacked by U.S. and Belgian troops when it ignored an order to halt. General Arnold said that Morgan has agreed to stop fighting and to move his troops to an area about 60 miles from the base of his main rival. Leaders from politics, the civil rights movement, and sports paid tribute today to the late Arthur Ashe. Kevin Hall reports from Richmond.
Virginia Governor Doug Wilder grew up with Arthur Ashe in segregated Richmond. Ashe became the first African American to win Wimbledon. Wilder became the nation's first black elected governor.
He knew what it meant to have to be better. He knew that the standard would be higher. He knew that the call sometimes would be against him when all the world knew they should have been. But he says, nevertheless, I'll be a champion. And he was.
New York City Mayor David Dinkins told Ash's daughter, Camera, that millions of people now will protect and watch out for her. Payment due, he called it, for the contribution of her father. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Hall in Richmond.
An FBI official said today that the Pakistani suspect in last month's CIA killings was apparently fled the country and may have returned to Pakistan. FBI Special Agent Jim DeSarno told a local TV station, WUSA, that the 28-year-old suspect, Mir Imal Khansi, appears to have gotten out of the country after being reported missing on January 28th. He said a raid on Khansi's apartment uncovered handguns, ammunition, and a bulletproof vest. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Bill Duke is a striking figure. He's a 6 feet, 4.5 inch tall African-American man with a shaved head. Maybe you saw him play opposite Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando and Predator. Duke makes a good bad guy, but more often, he's on the other side of the camera directing. Duke's feature films include A Rage in Harlem and Deep Cover. And he spent years in television directing episodes of Falcon Crest, Hill Street Blues, and Miami Vice. Bill Duke's new film may seem like an unlikely choice for him. The Cemetery Club is the story of three middle-aged Jewish women who are widowed and find themselves once again out on the dating circuit. These lifelong friends are played by Olympia Dukakis, Ellen Burstyn, and Diane Ladd. Neither Duke nor any of his leading ladies are Jewish, so to keep the film accurate, Duke says they had a rabbi on the set at all times.
The irony is that the more research I did and the more I talked to the rabbi, the more I understood that these people were very much like my relatives and my mother and my aunts, that the ceremonies and rituals were a bit different. But fundamentally, we're talking about people that work for a living and raise children and have values and love and believe in friendships. And I think there's a universality about a certain class of people in any culture that basically do that.
You know what I really enjoyed was seeing a movie where middle-aged actresses had lead roles. It made me realize what an unusual experience that is.
I think you are unfortunately right.
I mean, did that interest you too as someone that wants to get perhaps different faces up on the screen, that here was a chance to put in women that usually play supporting roles?
Well, not only that, but women that I have respected for a long time, actresses which I've wanted to see more of for years, like from Faye Dunaway to Ellen Burstyn. And after a certain period of time, Hollywood sometimes is not very kind to women in that age range. And those talents, I think, are at their peak, and they're at the height of their acting form. They have had more experience of living. Some of them have had children. And I find something very beautiful in all of that, and something very rich in the very nature of that experience that is not being explored. And unfortunately, it continues to be ignored.
Well, you know what else I notice is that you use a lot of close-ups. The camera moves very close to their faces, and you do see the lines. There isn't necessarily the soft lighting. You see the creases around their mouth. Did you do that on purpose? Is that normally the way you work very close-up?
Well, I had a long discussion with these ladies when I hired them, and I said, listen, I don't want to hide anything because I want to show the beauty of the aging face. I want to show the beauty of the experience of the person. So I don't want to gook it up with makeup and these filters that make you look like you're 20 miles away from the person, to avoid. And everybody knows you're avoiding the fact that they have wrinkles in their face anyway, so I think it's kind of silly. But I wanted to utilize and exploit that. And I would say it's a courageous act on their part to allow me to do that. I mean, I thought in the bedroom scene, for example, Ellen Burstyn was so sexy. I mean, with that green dress on and she and Danny, I mean, I thought it was passionate and erotic and sexy, and she played the woman of her age.
I'm speaking with director Bill Duke, and we're talking about a movie he has just finished, and it's coming out in the theaters called The Cemetery Club, and it stars Ellen Burstyn, Olympia Dukakis, Diane Ladd, and Danny Aiello. As a black director, are you expected to do black movies? Are there pressures on you to do black movies?
Unfortunately, if your face is black in Hollywood, you are relegated, for the most part, to doing films, directing films that have black people in them. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but we should be allowed to choose the kinds of films and the kinds of genres of films that we wish to direct and be involved in. I am very happy with this particular experience because I was hired based upon my talent and not my ethnicity. And I must compliment the Walt Disney Company and David Hoberman and Bridget Johnson, those people there, because they had the courage to do so. They got a lot of phone calls. You know, once people knew I was directing this film, what the hell is this black guy doing directing this film about Jews? What does he have in common with them?
Where were the phone calls coming from?
Well, from, you know, people in the industry that didn't understand, you know. There were a lot of directors that were up for it that were Jewish, and a lot of women were up there for it, you know, and they were wondering, what's going on, you know. And Disney and I always responded, what qualified me was my humanity, and if that was very difficult for them to understand, then they would, and they didn't get the joke.
The pressures, though, for a black director to do movies that deal with black themes, is that a marketing decision? Does that come from producers? Does it come from critics? Does it come from the audience? Where do you feel the pressure the most?
I think it comes from all directions, but most particularly the studios, because in protecting their investment, I think in their minds, they would like to get people who have either experienced these dilemmas or subject matters or plots in their minds, or have some familiarity with the people who are being depicted in these films. And I think that because of that, their vision, their range of vision, is sometimes very limited. So that I would never be considered to direct, Star Wars 6, because obviously my vision of the world is limited to my community, I think, to a certain extent as they see it.
This is the studio talking.
Yeah, because they don't see it, and so I have to, insist that my humanity transcends my ethnicity, and attempt in some way to change their minds. And if this film or any other films I do like this make money at the box office, not that they're critically acclaimed, because I think that's a secondary consideration, but if it makes money at the box office and makes a considerable profit, I think possibly that other directors of different ethnic hues will be allowed, perhaps, to do this.
You made your movie directorial debut with A Rage in Harlem.
Well, actually, it was one movie before that.
Oh, what was the movie?
And that was called The Killing Floor, which I directed for PBS. It was about the unionization of the Meatpackers Union in Chicago in the early 1900s.
Okay. You did make, though, A Rage of Harlem at the age of 48, is that right?
Yes.
Did you want to direct movies before then, but never had really been given the opportunity?
Yes. I wanted to direct features, in my 20s. But, it's been a long route for me, kind of like, I've gone around the long way to get back to the short way correctly, I guess you could say. But it's been a long time.
Well, you've made more than 100 television shows.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a detour for you, or is that just a way of getting in the movies? I mean, do you see that as time lost?
No, that's a double-edged sword television,
yeah.
Because it was an extremely wonderful training ground for me, because it enabled me to really have a great familiarity with the camera and work with actors and scripts and editing and pre-production and post-production and all the rest of that. you know, over and over and over again. So I've gained a great deal of confidence in my ability to deal with the technical aspect of film through, you know, television. At the same time, however, you can get stuck in television. The money's very, very good, and the residuals are even more wonderful. So you can create a lot. I created a lifestyle that I kind of got trapped by and detoured me in terms of, you know, kind of like off of my original goal.
So you really didn't want to take the risk in movies for fear of losing your lifestyle?
Yes, exactly. And my lifestyle was exactly the thing I had to sacrifice in order. I was making a lot more money than I ever thought I would make in television, and I was getting these physical ailments, headaches and backaches, and I went to the doctor, and he said, "There's nothing wrong with you." Oh. He says, "Why don't you cut down on your work?" And a friend of mine said, "Why don't you just, like, you know, do what you really want to do?" So I gave up. I just stopped directing television except for maybe three or four or five shows a year. I was doing 12, 13 or so. And believe it or not, all these physical symptoms started to disappear. And I started doing PBS. I directed Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun and a thing called The Meeting by Jeff Stetson about a fictitious meeting between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. And so, and those things are things that my heart was attached to. I went back to TV to do, like, movies of the week and, you know, things like pilots I really wanted to do. And once I think my heart was more involved in things, I began to get on track again. And then that's when I got my first feature, because a couple of feature producers saw my PBS work.
Well, what kind of a lifestyle are we talking about? How well were you living?
I had a Lloyd Wright house in the Hollywood Hills, and I had a nice big new Mercedes-Benz every couple of years. And it was like, you know, it's not bad.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we just have to take a very short break. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is director Bill Duke. He's made a number of movies, including A Rage in Harlem, and he was also, I'm looking here, also did Deep Cover with Larry Fishburne and Jeff Goldblum, and has appeared in a number of movies himself. We'll be talking a little bit more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with director Bill Duke. His latest movie, just out, is called The Cemetery Club. Now, my understanding is that your parents wanted you to be pre-med. Is that right?
Yes, and I very foolishly took some courses in which I failed miserably, you know, consecutively, lower grades three separate times. So I kind of got the message that maybe that wasn't it. But I always saw this gleam in the eye of these people cutting up dogs and cats and, you know, sand sharks, and I thought they were a little mad, you know. Then they said, well, you know, because my mother and father only went to attended the second and third grade, and they had to work, you know. So education, the first kid in their family to go to college, was a mm-hmm. big deal. So you had to be something practical to make money and not have to go through the things they went through.
So how did you tell them that you weren't interested in this pre-med?
Well, I my grades were so bad, I think they obviously kind of caught on to that and they understood. So they said, well, the next best thing, since you want to be in the arts, well, you want, so be an English teacher. That's close enough. You write all the time. So if you're a teacher, you can always fall back on that. And I went to BU, and I had fallen asleep for the third time in my Chaucer class, and the teacher asked me to leave. And a friend who was my roommate, Israel Hicks, he said, you know, Bill, you've been talking about acting and writing for a long time. I got a friend, Lloyd Richards, who was a teacher over here in the School of the Arts. Why don't you audition? I said, I have nothing to lose, so I did. And I got in. And that next semester, you know, the gleam that I had seen in my classmates' eyes cutting up those dogs was in my eye. It was like coming home, you know. I was coming home to a feeling of, like, you know, I belonged. I was always, like, I felt weird outside of this environment.
You mentioned the fact that your parents really didn't even complete elementary school. Where did you live, and what kinds of jobs did they have? What was your childhood like?
Well, my childhood was both horrible and wonderful. I mean, I guess like everybody says, horrible and wonderful. But my images of my father was a man who was determined to take his family out of a relatively ghetto situation. So he actually, literally, believe it or not, got five jobs simultaneously from time to time.
He was working five jobs?
He would go into the foundry and work from 12 until 8 in the morning, and then he'd come from the foundry and he would go on the bread route. In those days, we delivered bread, and he'd work on the bread route for a couple of hours, and then he would go blacktopping, and that is, you know, you have these steamrollers that repair potholes in the street, and he would be working the steamroller, and he would work on that for a while. Then he'd come home, and my mother would fix his lunch, dinner, so to speak, and she put this big board across this sitting chair he used to have, and my memories of my father are always with a half-finished meal in front of him, and he'd just fall asleep. You know, and never finished. You know, I don't think my father ever finished a meal in his life until he was much older.
So you never saw much of your father then growing up?
Not very much at all. And then on the weekends, the only time I would see him, and we were working, we would dig dry wells, which were like, you know, these ditches that were 6 to 8 feet deep and 3 to 4 feet wide that would be filled with stone. And then when it rained, the gutter would lead into this ditch, and it would disperse the water evenly throughout a lawn so that it wouldn't back up and to the foundation and erode the foundation of the houses. And then we on the Sunday, my sister, my mother, and my father and I would clean bowling alleys. And you know, so that was my childhood on that level. Then the other side of it was when we were very poor, which was almost a better time for us. We couldn't afford to go to the films. And I loved movies when I was a little kid, but my father felt bad about that, so he used to take us down to Main Street, Poughkeepsie, New York, and he'd make my mother pop a bag of popcorn, and we would sit in our car, and his way of making the movies for us would be, we'd watch people, and he would say, "What do you think that guy does, you know?" We'd say, "What do you mean?" And he would say, "Well, look at the shoes, how his shoes are worn on the sides, and look at the coat he's wearing, and, you know, how old is, you know, how much money do you think he makes?" And so, you know, it was a game we played that not until much later that I understood, you know, was shaping me into an actor and a filmmaker, which are really observers of people and reporters of people's behaviors.
Were your parents ever bitter at all about the condition of their lives?
Yes, I think they were very angry. You know, my father, you know, to a certain extent, I would say, was a racist. You know, I think my father and mother have seen, my father's deceased now, my mother's still living, but I think they'd both come from the South. My father's from Orange, Virginia. My mother's was from West Point, Mississippi. My father came to Poughkeepsie very early. And, you know, they in the South in those days, you know, this is before Dr. King, you know. And my mother tells stories of some of the things that she's seen that happened to relatives and friends that I think, you know, they're kind of permanent scars. And to their credit, you know, I don't think they hate anybody, but I think that they have been scarred by those experiences.
Did they make remarks? I mean, you said you thought your parents were racist. Did they make remarks?
Not my parents, my father more than
your father more. But would he say things?
Yes. Yeah, he would say things. He would say, he would say things out of pain. You know, he would say things that reflected his experience in this country, trying to be a man and try to raise his family and being discriminated against in the way that he was. You know, he was, because he had no education, he was at the bottom of the barrel of a lot of things. But he was a brilliant man. He was a very creative person, and I think that was a great torture for him.
Let me ask you about another part of your career. You first got into theater just by acting. How did you get then from acting to directing? What was the transition there?
Well, I started out as a stage director and couldn't get arrested. You know, I just couldn't survive. You know, I was working in New York, directing my own plays and plays for other people. And I never made over $3,000 a year, you know, just an unemployment and the rest of it, and just going downhill. And so I started acting, and that helped. I was in a Broadway play for like a year, but I still wanted to direct. But the equipment of film was very intimidating to me. And so I went away to BU and got into, you know, theater courses, and then came back to New York again, and then came out to California. And I was in a series on television for 2 seasons called Palmerstown USA. And I thought I was going to, you know, I'd made it. I was co-starring in it, and then the series ended, and I didn't work for 2 years. And then I made a 45-minute short called The Hero, which won some awards, and I tried to shop it around to studios for a couple of years. No one would buy it, or no one would hire me as director. And then I was at a meditation retreat in Calistoga, and I was meditating. My agent called me. He said, "They want you to do a Knots Landing." I thought, I couldn't believe it. And so I came back, and I met the producer, David Jacobs. He says, "I want you to do this, you know, this project." And so I was prepping. My first Knots Landing, I was prepping. And the last day of prep, which was the seventh day, Joe Wallenstein, the producer, called me to his office, and he said, "You know, I like your prep and your and good luck tomorrow, but I could tell you're going to be great from your reel." I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "I don't have a reel." He says, "What are you talking?" I said, "All I have is a short film from AFI." So he runs out of the office, and he comes back, and what had happened was they had mixed my film up with a reel from a director, and they wanted to fire me on the spot, but it was the last day of prep, and they couldn't. And so I went through and directed The Knots Landing, and then they gave me a second one, and that's how my career started.
You mentioned earlier that when you were doing television, you were living very well, living in a Frank Lloyd Wright house and having new Mercedes Benz.
It's a Lloyd Wright house. It's his son.
Lloyd Wright. Oh.
Not quite Frank yet.
Oh, okay.
But,
son of Frank.
Son of Frank's house.
Son of Frank Lloyd Wright's house. And also driving a Mercedes Benz, a new one every couple of years. Where do you live now, and what do you drive now?
Well,
how much have you dropped? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Well, you know, I live in a rented house in the Pacific Palisades that I like very much, and nice ocean view. And I have a Lexus car, and it's less important to me now. I think, you know, as I'm older, my focus is more on, I want to make a couple of great films before I get out of here. You know, I really want to make a few films that really communicate something that is important and that affect people and in a way that's significant.
Well, I thank you very much, Bill Duke, for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
This is very pleasant, and I really appreciate it.
Bill Duke's new film is called The Cemetery Club. I'm Artie Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Artie Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Seventeen years ago, journalist Betty Rollin had a hard time getting her book published about surviving breast cancer. Publishers didn't think women wanted to read about that kind of thing. But Rollin's book became a bestseller, serving as a guide for thousands of women who also had to face the disease. Now it's being reissued. Coming up, we talk with Betty Rollin about surviving a second battle with breast cancer and about helping her terminally ill mother die. Also, commentator Maureen Carrigan reviews the new memoir, H.L. Mencken, My Life as Author and Editor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Clinton administration has announced that it will work to improve a UN European Community plan to end the fighting in Bosnia. Speaking to reporters in Washington this afternoon, Secretary of State Warren Christopher ruled out military means to end the fighting, but said the U.S. would be prepared to take military action to enforce a peace agreement if and when one is reached. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The Muslim-led Bosnian government has rejected the UNEC plan because it allows the Serbs to keep some of the territory they captured by force. Serbs have balked at the plan, too. Christopher said the U.S. would pressure the Serbs to make more concessions by seeking tighter sanctions against Serbia. The U.S. plan pressures the Bosnian government to settle by keeping a UN arms embargo in place, dashing Bosnian hopes that outside powers will help them repulse the Serbs militarily. President Clinton has named veteran diplomat Reginald Bartholomew to be his special envoy on Bosnia. If the warring parties agree to a peace settlement, Christopher said the U.S. is prepared to do its share to enforce it, including possible military action. He said it was premature to say whether U.S. ground troops might be involved in that action. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
President Clinton is now on his first major out-of-town trip since being sworn into office. This evening in Detroit, he will take part in a nationally broadcast town hall meeting. With questions from a studio audience and by satellite from Seattle, Atlanta, and Miami, Mr. Clinton is expected to try and concentrate on his economic program. President Clinton announced plans today to cut 100,000 jobs from the federal workforce. He also said that he will eliminate some perks for senior officials and do away with one-third of some 700 advisory boards and federal commissions. The moves followed the president's announcement yesterday that he will cut the White House staff by 25%. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
During the campaign, Mr. Clinton promised to shrink the size of government. Now he's trying to make that happen. He said no layoffs are planned. Instead, 100,000 jobs can be eliminated through attrition. Some 200,000 of the more than 2 million in the federal workforce leave each year for retirement or other reasons. The president said the steps he's taking today will save $9 billion.
They won't be easy, but they will make a difference. We have an obligation and an opportunity to change the way government works and to show that government can do more with less.
This week's cuts are an effort to reassure taxpayers that the government is tightening its belt. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 2 points to close at 3,412.42 on volume of more than 248 million shares. This is NPR News. Officials in Mexico say at least 24 people have been murdered in a village north of Acapulco. Police say some 50 gunmen opened fire on two trucks carrying family members to a funeral. Officials say that early investigations indicate a possible drug trafficking dispute or a fight over land rights between two families may be behind the massacre. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Colin Powell, is denying a report that he has decided to step down early because of disagreements with the Clinton administration. NPR's John Greenberg has more on the story.
A story in today's New York Times quoted unnamed close associates of Powell as saying the general plans to leave a few months before his term runs out in September. The report said Powell thinks the Clinton administration wants to cut too deeply into the defense budget and is too eager to lift the ban against gays in the military. Appearing on CNN, Powell said he has been thinking for some time that he might leave a month or two early, but that plan only reflected the needs of his family.
I have no intention of leaving early for the purpose of expressing any disgruntlement or unhappiness with the policies of the new administration.
White House spokesman George Stephanopoulos also denied the report. He said the president wants Powell to stay for a full term. Powell has already said that he has no interest in serving a third term. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Government officials in Germany are predicting harder times for the nation. For the first time in 9 years, Western Germany is expected to have a shrinking economy. Unemployment in all of Germany is expected to go up over the next 11 months. Officials blame Germany's economic worries on a huge bill to pay for unification, along with slow economic ties around the world. Germany's unemployment is expected to rise to 9% from 7.7%. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When Betty Rollin wrote about her struggle with breast cancer nearly 20 years ago, her book became a bestseller. Little had been written on the subject, especially by someone who had gone through the experience. Her book was entitled First You Cry, and its success turned Rollin into a role model for other women faced with the disease and hungry for advice on how to cope. Her book was made into a TV movie starring Mary Tyler Moore. Rollin was a TV news reporter when she first got breast cancer. She's currently a contributing correspondent for NBC News. Rollin wrote about another personal matter 10 years later when she helped her mother, who had ovarian cancer, commit suicide. That book was called Last Wish and described her mother's determination to die and Rollin's efforts to help her. First You Cry has just been reissued in paperback because a lot has changed in the understanding and treatment of breast cancer. A lot has also changed for Rollin. She had breast cancer again in 1984. Even though her health is good, Rollin says every day she lives with some fear.
Frankly, not to be too Pollyanna about it, but that little bit of fear that one has, it can be a good thing in life. I think that it, all of those corny things, that little bit of fear makes you, focuses you, makes you a lot more grateful for being around. I found it useful.
How would you say that you have changed since you had breast cancer? How are you a different person?
Well, it's interesting. They've republished this book, First You Cry, and since they republished it, I thought I would reread it after 17 years. So I reread it, and as I reread it, I thought, what is this lady making such a fuss about? And that in itself, that reaction to the book, made me realize how far I've come, how different life is for me today than the way what it was when I was first hit with this thing. And it also, by the way, made me glad that I didn't revise the book. I mean, there's a new introduction and a new epilogue, but I didn't change the actual story, because it's a story of what happens when this thing hits you, breast cancer, and what you feel and what you go through and how you come out of it, and about sexuality and all of that stuff. And today, all of that, just, I feel so far from all of that. Even though I had it again 9 years ago, I mean, I feel personally grateful, happy. I'm in this terrific second marriage that happened post-cancer. I like to say cancer improved my taste in men, though I'm not recommending it as a way to do that, but it had that odd result, because I think what happened is that, like a lot of women, I kind of gravitated towards slightly punishing men, and when breast cancer hit, that itself was such a punishment that it sort of made me more interested in, or feel more interested in nicer men. That's my private theory about that. Although I've heard similar stories from other women. You know, when you write a book about yourself and about something like this that's happened to you, you hear, it's almost like a letter. I mean, you hear back from people. They write you back and they say, me too, you know, yes, I went through that. And I've heard over the years a lot of nice things about men and about relationships.
What is your feeling about implants? You had implants put in, right?
I have saline implants, which I find very satisfactory. And, of course, if saline leaks, it's only water, so it can't hurt you. Now, I would advise any woman getting implants to get saline for that reason. I mean, silicone, there have been problems with silicone.
Yes.
It's debatable whether these awful diseases that some women have had have been caused by silicone leakage. But frankly, you know, why take the chance?
Mm. Did you have any hesitations about getting implants?
I took a long time to do it. I didn't have them right away. I waited, and in a way, it's good that I waited, because by the time I had the implants, I had two breasts to replace instead of one. So if I had had the one, then I would have had to match it. That would have been harder. So this way, I started out with a clean slate, so to speak. It also, writing about the whole prosthesis hunt in yeah. First You Cry gave me a very funny scene, which I wouldn't otherwise have had.
Well, do implants take some getting used to?
No, they're really kind of like new little breasts. I mean, mm-hmm. They're not exactly, obviously, like new little breasts, but they're terrific. They stay up. You don't have to wear a bra. They're wonderful. I mean, my friends are jealous. What can I tell you?
Reporter Betty Rollins' book about her breast cancer, First You Cry, has just been reissued. More with Betty Rollins after this short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Betty Rollins, and we're talking about a book she wrote a number of years ago called First You Cry, and it's her story about overcoming breast cancer. Do you think just because the statistics are improved and that breast cancer is no longer a taboo word, it's easier to talk about it, that it's actually easier for a woman to cope with a diagnosis?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think it's a terrible shock to find out you have breast cancer. Terrible. Possibly it's slightly less terrible now than it was when I first got it in 1975, because you certainly know you have company. And I hope you know that you have a good chance of living. But it's still a terrible shock. One of the reasons is that breast cancer doesn't hurt. You're not sick first. So when it happens to you, it's very sudden, mostly very out of the blue. And it really just turns you upside down. And it's funny, I reread First You Cry recently, and I was shocked to see how upside down I was.
Yeah, yeah.
when I wrote this book. I mean, I felt so distant from it. But I realized that upside down feeling and the getting right side up is a process that women are going through still, even though they know they have company, even though they are better educated. I think emotionally it really topples you.
How, though, do you suggest to women, and I assume you probably get letters and phone calls from women all the time you've become such a spokeswoman on this issue. What advice do you have for them to get used to what's happened to their body, to get to know their body in a different kind of way? How do you broach this issue with somebody else?
Well, in a sense, each person has to go through her own process, and it takes time. And if you're feeling down in the dumps and miserable, sometimes I say to people, well, let yourself grieve. You know, it's a kind of death in the body. And sometimes you need to grieve, and it's a mistake I've found over the years to say, "Oh, it's fine, it's nothing. Cheer up, you know, it'll be great, it's nothing." I mean, people have to take their own time. I do say, you know, in time you will feel, just know that in time you will feel differently about this. You will feel differently. Let yourself grieve, but this will pass. And just keep that thought that this will pass. Think about the other things in your life that have happened to you that have just toppled you and struck you down that you got over. You will get over this too. You will change your feelings.
Have you found that your advice has changed over the years as time has gone on and you've changed and your life has changed as well? That you have a kind of perspective on it that you didn't have 10, 5, 15 years ago?
Well, I mean, as you get old, you get, one likes to think, a little bit wiser. I think I feel, in a strange way, grateful to cancer. And I certainly didn't feel that at first. And I feel grateful, certainly because I've lived, but I feel grateful because I think that's the biggest change. Because as I look behind me and as I look at what's happened to me since I've had cancer, I see so many good things, and I see that my life has been so rich, and I see that I've appreciated so much more than I did before, and that I'm more focused and all of that. So that's the change for me, in not only being happier but noticing it. Noticing it is a big part of it. You know, a lot of people, there's no point in being happy unless you notice it.
Right. What kind of letters and phone calls do you get? And you said you get lots of those. And these
well,
are just
I get the most wonderful letters and phone. Well, the phone calls are usually not so. I mean, the phone calls are usually women who are in a panic and terror in the voice, and those are not so wonderful. But I like, you know, I can't say I enjoy those calls, but I try to be helpful, and it's a nice feeling to think you might be helpful. But the letters are just great. The letters are usually from women who will say, you know, as I was reading what you were feeling and First You Cry, I felt, oh, I was there too. That's just so much what I was feeling, and I thought I was totally crazy, and my mother is just like your mother. My husband is just like your husband. And then they tell me their breast cancer jokes. I mean, there's a lot of humor in First You Cry, and I'll get this wonderful letter. I got one just recently. My dog ate my prosthesis. And, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's wonderful. It's warm. It's a kind of closeness to people you don't know. That is a real joy of writing about yourself in an intimate way.
You assisted in your mother's suicide. She
yes.
had cancer. She had ovarian cancer.
Yes.
If you hadn't had cancer yourself, would you have been more reluctant to help her?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, the fact that I had cancer myself perhaps made me more sensitive to her situation. But my mother begged me to help her to die. It was her wish. It really had nothing to do with me or what I wanted or what I thought. That book was called Last Wish, and the word wish was very important because it was her wish. It was what she wanted. It was her begging me to do this. It really had nothing to do with me or my wish it was horrible for me to lose her, but this was what she wanted, and there was no doubt in my mind that it was what she wanted. So I think it would have been the same, frankly, if I had, whether or not I had cancer, I don't think really would have affected it. I love my mother, and it seemed to me her wish, it was a reasonable wish given her situation. She was terminally ill, suffering at the end anyway. She just wanted to be spared the last horrible few months, and I thought that seemed reasonable to me.
Going through your mother's death and having to deal with breast cancer yourself, do you think about how you want to die and what you're willing and not willing to do? It's a subject that none of us really wants to think about or even talk about.
Much more I think about how I want to live.
Yeah.
But of course I think about how I want to die and here's what I think about that. I mean, I would like, as everyone, to die in my sleep at the age of 98 or so.
Sure.
But I would like to know. I've become very active in this movement, I suppose you'd call it, to legalize physician-assisted suicide, because if I have so much mail from people, many. Some have AIDS. Some are elderly people. Some are people who are not sick, but they're just frightened. People who get to the end of life, they're desperate. They want out. They're suffering. They are terminally ill, and they need help. And I just feel that we must not turn our backs on these people, and we need to legalize physician-assisted suicide with safeguards in place. Very important. But there's a way to do this, and anyone who read my mail would feel the same way. I mean, this is a population you don't know about, you don't hear about. They're hidden. You know, they're lying there, some of them, unable to do anything but blink their eyelids, and they need help. You know what it is? The most important thing about this, I think, is that it's the feeling of security, of insurance, of calm. When my mother knew that she had a way out, a calm came over her, just to know that she wasn't trapped, you know, whether or not she took the step.
You mentioned that you live with a small dose of fear. I mean, having had breast cancer twice, I guess you can't ever entirely get away from that feeling. Are there days when you feel just much more mortal than others?
Yes, there are. And very often those are days when someone dies. Mm-hmm. And I hear from a lot of people, most of them live, but some of them die. And when someone dies, I feel, why them? Why that person? Why not me? And there's no answer to that. I mean, some people think there is, you know, they think because they've prayed or something, but, you know, who lives and who dies and who gets a cancer that spreads and who gets one that's... I mean, all of this stuff is just so... There's no logic, there's no rhyme or reason. It's just luck and genes and who knows. And so all of that chanciness of it all makes one feel mortal, yes.
Well, I thank you very much, Betty Rowland, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
I thank you.
Betty Rowland's book on her battle with breast cancer, First You Cry, has been reissued in paperback. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Robert, what stories do you have for us?
Well, we'll be reporting on the policy toward Bosnia announced today by Secretary of State Warren Christopher. We'll also be following up on a cut in state welfare benefits enacted in Michigan in 1991. Last week, producer Art Silverman and I traveled around Michigan talking with people who were cut from welfare back then. They used to get $220 a month. We'll find out what some of them have done since then. Their stories vary, and they're all pretty interesting. We'll also be hearing about a symphony by Henryk Gorecki, contemporary Polish composer, that is so popular in Britain right now, it's become a gold record. We'll find out why.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Before writer and critic H.L. Mencken died in 1956, he sent some heavy wooden boxes sealed with iron bands to a public library in his hometown of Baltimore. In his will, Mencken stipulated that the boxes not be opened until 35 years after his death. When they were unsealed in January 1991, they were found to contain an unfinished manuscript entitled H.L. Mencken, My Life as Author and Editor. It was nearly 2,000 pages long. A greatly trimmed edition of Mencken's memoir has just been published, and commentator Maureen Cargan says it's so wicked she wishes she could read the whole thing.
I once read that when John Keats decided to get serious about writing poetry, he hung two portraits above his desk, one of Shakespeare, the other of Milton. Keats thought that even if he never matched or beat these masters, their wise eyes would always frighten him into trying his best. I'd suspect that many contemporary critics also have hung up a portrait, even if it's just a ghostly one, over their computers. The portrait is of H.L. Mencken, and I know that mine is one of those trick kind that changes expression. Whenever I type out a stinky sentence, my Mencken portrait rolls his eyes and then pours another one of his famous coffin varnish cocktails. Mencken is complacent because he knows that no writer sweating under his stare is likely to ever share that space on the wall with him. Despite the recent controversies over his private prejudices, I still think H.L. Mencken was, arguably, the greatest popular American social and literary critic of the 20th century. If you don't know why that is, read some of his essays collected in volumes like The American Language and Notes on Democracy. If you do know your Mencken, you'll want to read his memoir, My Life as Author and Editor. Mencken started writing it in 1942, and it focuses on his career during the 20s, when he and George G. Nathan were editing the famous literary magazine, The Smart Set, as well as pulps like The Black Mask, The Parisienne, and Saucy Stories. During his Smart Set years, Mencken met or reviewed all the heavyweights, James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, Ernest Hemingway, D.H. Lawrence. The great fun of reading this memoir is hearing Mencken gleefully dismiss almost all of them as duds, boozers, and bogus eminentissimos. He even takes a swipe at Helen Keller. Mencken, in his words, whooped up a lot of writers, too, but he was never so blinded by their genius that he didn't note their all-too-human flaws. For instance, Mencken championed the novels of Theodore Dreiser, and the two men became good friends. But Dreiser, apparently, was too egotistical to ever comment on Mencken's own celebrated writings. Mencken complains that the only one of my ideas that got any real response from him was the idea that he was a great novelist. Of course, Mencken was not without flaws himself. When his diaries were published a couple of years ago, many readers were shocked by his anti-Semitic remarks, especially since many of his close friends were Jewish. I disagree with critic Jonathan Yardley, who edited this memoir and who claims that Mencken, by the standards of his own time, was not anti-Semitic. The Jew, not a Jew references here are just too obsessive. But just as Mencken distinguished between Sinclair Lewis, whom he called an idiot, and Lewis's novel Main Street, which he called a masterpiece, I think we fans have to distinguish between the often bigoted man and his incisive, truth-telling essays. This is the very kind of contradiction that never failed to set Mencken himself howling.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed H.L. Mencken, My Life as Author and Editor. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk and Audrey Fablitis. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, meet film director, actor, writer Harold Ramis. He says in high school he was the one who wrote the jokes for the class clown, and he's made a career of it. His movies include Animal House, Caddyshack, and Ghostbusters. His latest is Groundhog Day with Bill Murray. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.